Again, the topic of love is an enormous one. You know, in a search of the Bible, we can look at that and we'll find it hundreds of times. Go through a couple of different definitions of it, and we'll go through those in the sermon here today. But many of the verses that we see are simple instructions or straightforward examples on how we need to live a loving way of life. You know, whether it's the interaction that we have with people at work. Work has been very stressful this last week. For our particular work, we print publications, and therefore when there's a shutdown for a holiday and UPS and FedEx and everybody else shuts down, the customers still want their product out, and so it needs to get done earlier. So everybody's on heightened awareness and concern. So if everybody's not talking just right, things don't get in on time, they don't get processed, sometimes through two or three stages and out on time. And so it's been a very hectic time. And so nerves have been a little bit frayed and voices have been a little bit raised. And again, we have to be careful that we don't fall into that. That we always use love as that filter. And love brings with it patience and understanding of people, recognition that sometimes we're going to do something a little bit wrong. Sometimes the systems are not going to work. Sometimes somebody else is perhaps going to be at odds or at fault. And yet if we approach love life with love as a general filter, we're going to help those around us, and we're going to help make God a little bit more proud of ourselves. And we're going to set the example that people maybe in retrospect finally come back and recognize, because again, they're frazzled at the moment. They may not recognize it. They may not see it. They're defensive in general in their posture. But they'll come back later to recognize that how is it a person is patient and kind and appreciative and appropriate in all situations? Well, it's because we work from a standpoint of love. The concept of love is a very deep one, a very broad one. It's actually a series of sermons could easily be given on it. You know, when we look at some of the scriptures that we can read about it, you can turn to 1 John 4:8. And it tells us here that God is love. You know, I understand that to some degree, but again, when I try to understand, pure and simple, what does that mean, that God is love, and that we in our lives should reflect that? How do you wrap your head around that? How do you think of that on a daily basis? And how do you put that into work, into your life? Another scripture that we often read in regard to love is John 15, verse 13. John chapter 15 and verse 13, where it says, greater love has no one than this, than to lay down his life for his friends. We know that Christ did that. Christ sacrificed his love or life out of love for mankind. But how is it that we can put that into our lives? We're not going to throw ourselves on a grenade on a daily basis type of thing and sacrifice our life. But we do it when we take a back seat, when our nerves get a little bit frazzled and somebody else is maybe, you know, they're hollering in our face. And when we sacrifice our position or our authority or our right to justice to jump back in their face, we effectively sacrifice our position by saying, you know, I'm not going to go there. Out of love and out of trying to reflect God's sacrifice and love and patience, I'm not going to go there. And we make those little sacrifices on a daily basis. So there's things that we can do and see in our lives where we can show greater love for mankind. And we need to do that. So in the message today, then, let's look a little bit more closely at this concept of love. It's a critical step in the process of us becoming sons and daughters of our Father in heaven. The Greek language has three primary words for love, and I'll go through... Am I going to go through the three of them, or I'm just going to look at one? It says, which enable us to distinguish passionate devotion, which is eros, and warm affection, which is philia, from Christian love, which is the word agape, which, again, we've heard of in years past. Vine's Expository Dictionary has the following to say about agape. It says, agape is used, and I'm going to go through this in more detail, so maybe just listen for the first pass here. It says, agape is used to describe the attitude of God's love toward His Son, toward the human race generically, and further, and then thirdly, thirdly, to recognize those that are believers, so those that are the family of God, if you will. Secondly, it says to convey his will to his children concerning their attitude toward others, and so I already talked about that a little bit, and how we perceive the input from other people and then how we react to that. And then it also, this word agape expresses the essential nature of God. So, you know, when we read in Isaiah 55:9, it says, "For as high as the heavens are above the earth, so are my ways higher than yours." And so God says that as much as you can begin to understand the concept of love and how you interact with your family and your spouse, with your neighbors and your coworkers, recognize that you're only beginning to scratch the surface as far as what God is, as we say God is love. Again, we try to understand that, wrap our eyes around it, and then do a better job of it each day. There are 6 points made by the author in regard to this section from Vine's Expository Dictionary. 6 facets that show that broad application of love, and I'd like to go through the list in a little bit more detail. So I'll go through these 6 points that were given in Vine's. I mentioned there were 3 basic areas, and again, these 6 give it in a little bit more detail. So the first one is God's love toward His Son, and the verse that He gives in reference to this is John 17, verse 26. John chapter 17 and verse 26, and He says, "Here Christ is speaking to the Father, and it says, 'I have declared to them your name, and I will declare it, that the love with which you loved me may be in them, and I in them.'" So again, what we're recognizing here is the love between two supreme beings, and ultimately how that is set as the highest stage, if you will. You have 2 spiritually supreme or mature beings, if you will, and the true relationship of love between those two would be that highest level. The second one that I mentioned was God's love toward mankind in a general sense. And Romans chapter 5 and verse 8 was given as the reference for this particular concept of love. Romans chapter 5 and verse 8, where it says, "But God demonstrates His own love toward us, that in while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." So Christ has died, made that sacrifice for all of mankind, ultimately. And we recognize the value of that today, that sacrifice that was made, and we try to live our lives on a higher standard because of that. But really, that sacrifice was made for all of mankind. So that's the 2 beings of the God family right now that have made that sacrifice, agreed to that sacrifice for all of mankind. That's a profound love between God and mankind as a whole. Thirdly, we mentioned that God's love toward believers specifically. So this is to a smaller portion of mankind, those that His mind or whose minds have been opened to a relationship and that higher standard, as we talked about. And we can turn to John chapter 14 and verse 21 in this regard. John chapter 14 and verse 21. Again, this third concept being God's love toward believers specifically. And John chapter 14 and verse 21 says, "He who has my commandments and keeps them," so God published those commandments out there, but we know that many people don't follow them. They don't understand them. They're not aware of them, or they disagree with them because their mind has not been opened.
That was beautiful.
So it says, "He who has my commandments and keeps them, it is he who loves me. And he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him." So again, this is a mutual love between Father and Son, and the family of Christ as it stands today. The 4th point goes on to say how we should love our brethren. So now we've moved from spiritual family of God showing love to each other and to mankind, and now it comes down to, as the commandments are often, we say, you know, the first group works with how we interact with God, and the second group is how we interact with man. This is the same concept here, as these last 3 points really focus on how love should be shown between individuals, and so how we should love our brethren. And here we've got John chapter 13 and verse 34. John chapter 13, verse 34, where it says, "A new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another as I have loved you." So as we recognize there is love between God and Christ and us, the sacrifice that has been made and the example that has been set for us, it says that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. And it goes on to say in verse 35, "By this shall all men know that you are my disciples." So when they see that closeness, when they see that relationship between us as family members, When we come here and Marv walks in and he sees the camaraderie and he sees the smiles and he sees the busyness and the help that we're all doing and the meal and the things that are brought and the fellowship that's shown after, the world sees that there's a warmth, that there's a love here between the family that they don't see in many others. You know, people walk down the street and they very seldom even lift their eyes to acknowledge you. I do that all the time. As I'm walking by somebody, I'm always looking them in the eye. I'm looking for the opportunity to smile at them and greet them, even if it's literally just in passing. But the majority of people won't even lift their eyes. They're not comfortable showing that camaraderie to a stranger. And so again, they recognize that there's a special bond, a love between brethren that clearly ties them back to God. That's point number four, or concept number four in this particular passage. Point number five is how we should show love toward all men. So again, when we're out in the general public, with our neighbors that we're going to have a certain relationship with our coworkers that we're going to have a certain relationship with, but also with the general public, somebody we walk by in the grocery store, or hold a door for at McDonald's, or pick up their, you know, their change purse when they drop it at a gas station, anything like that. Again, the love that we show toward all people. 1 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 12. 1 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 12. Paul here is writing to he's writing to the church in Thessalonica. That always throws me. Thank you. I'm not the only one that does that. He goes on to say, "And the Lord make you to increase and abound in love one toward another and toward all men, even as we do toward you." So, we recognize the different levels of love and the different levels of relationship that develop over time. That's what a relationship is something that is developed. And so it says that we should show love toward all men. Again, this is a godly love that extended to all men, the willingness to help, to be a generally positive effect in the lives of all those around us. And finally, that final note that we made from the front is that love portrays the general, the essential nature of God. And we can go to 1 John 4:8 in reading about that particular point. So again, what we recognize is that love is a many-faceted thing and that it comes into play in all our relationships and in different levels based on what those relationships are. But again, 1 John 4:8, it says, "He that loves not clearly doesn't know God." So that person that won't raise their eyes, that person that steps away from a situation instead of reaching in to help, it says, "He that loves not clearly doesn't know God, for God is love." Again, it brings us back full circle to the fact of who God is, who His Son is, and at their very core, their very nature is love. Every moment, every day, with everybody they come in contact, and ultimately the desire to have each and every person that has ever walked on this earth as part of the family to truly experience that higher level of love. Brethren, we can see from this that the concept of love is a complex one. It's an integral part of every relationship that exists, no matter how large or how small, that we can show that love, we can show that concern and that appreciation for others. Let's turn, brethren, as the basis for the sermon then, really, is to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. We refer to it as the love chapter. Probably the most exhaustive treatment of what love is and how it is practiced, how it is shown. There's a couple of dozen descriptors here about what is love and how is it practiced and how is it shown and how is it provided or extended to other people. And so we're going to go through that in detail. And first of all, some context, though, before we start this. In regard to the book of 1 Corinthians, it addresses a somewhat dysfunctional group of Christians in what had become a very ungodly city. And so as we look at perhaps this world, and you know, you can read in the Bible, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah, certain things come to mind when you say, you know, Hollywood maybe, Los Angeles maybe, New York City, when you consider certain areas or certain groups of population that are ungodly, some more than others perhaps. But Corinth was a major commercial metropolis in Greece, one of the largest and richest and most important cities in the Roman Empire. Halley's Bible Handbook refers to it as a renowned and voluptuous city. Right there, when a city is described with a term voluptuous, it's something that's sexy, it's something that's exciting, and we know that that by and large, in human beings, that's going to set aside from something that would be righteous or godly. Again, it's a renowned and a voluptuous city where the vice of East and West met, it said. Again, a definition of voluptuous says, given to or spent in enjoyment of luxury, pleasure, or sensual gratification. Okay, the second point I want to do in regard to context for 1 Corinthians, we have to recognize that at the point where this is written, it's been just a few short years since Paul had founded the church in Corinth. And so while he was there, he was, you know, very intensely involved in the personalities, in the people, in the lives, and in the setup of the church. And as he then left it in capable hands and had work to do in other places, he had now gone his way. So in a relatively short time, this group in Corinth had gotten involved in their own side business, their side lights. They had become included in the pride and the politics and the issues of that city. When they were surrounded by it, it had its impact on their particular lives. And so again, that included the politics and the day-to-day practices. Some of the immoral participation that they had been in was, again, incest and legal wranglings and so on. So what we recognize here, as this book is written, as this 1 Corinthians chapter 13 is written about what love is, how it should be practiced, and how it should raise their activity to a higher level, we have to recognize part of the reason for why it was being written and to whom. And again, finally, Paul's letter seeks to address the issues in this fledgling church that needed to be pulled back to the straight and narrow, back to the standard that was God's. Adam Clark's commentary on chapter 13, or the love chapter as we call it, says this. It says, at the conclusion of the preceding chapter, the apostle promised to show the Corinthians a more excellent way than that in which they were now proceeding. They were so distracted with contentions, divided by or into parties, and envious of each other's gifts, that the unity was nearly destroyed in their particular congregation. Again, just a few short years after Paul had been there and so involved in their lives. It was evident that love to God and man was wanting, and that without this, their numerous gifts and other graces were nothing in the eyes of God. So regardless of the capacity that you have, the skills that you have, if they're not practiced in the right way, they're not productive to their full limit. So Paul, by his advice and direction, gives discourse to the many abuses and shows them how to walk in such a way as to please God. So this gives us a little insight into the first section of chapter 13 as to why it's being written, who it's being addressed to, and how they're supposed to be receiving it. Let's move into then a detailed coverage of the chapter. We'll begin in 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 1. We'll go through again, we'll read through this, and I'll take little sidebars here and there to explain what it is that's going on here. Now, brethren, as I mentioned again, this message being written a few years ago, now as my mind begins to warm up to it, I know there's a couple of references to things that had been happening to me at the time that I used as reference. They may be a little out of date, so if I halt a little bit, I hope you'll understand. Again, 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 1. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I have become as sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. So regardless of how smooth someone's speech has been, regardless of how experienced someone is in the public light, regardless of how comfortable they may be up here in front of a microphone and teaching or preaching, if they're doing it with that pride, if they're doing it out of a show of grandeur, and they're doing it not with love for the audience and the need to teach and to preach and to edify, then it says, I've become as a clanging cymbal or a sounding brass. It's noise. It's not edifying the Father. It's not helping the individual that's sitting there taking notes to say, okay, wait a minute, I hear what you're saying, I hear the experience or the example that you're using, and I can see that because it relates to something that I went through, whether recently or further back. What I'm hearing up there is like Charlie Brown, blah, 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 because I see what you're doing and the smell with which you're doing it, instead of truly out of love for who you're giving it to, it's become as a clanging cymbal or sounding brass. It's become noise. Verse 2, and though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith, so that I could move mountains, but I have not love, I am nothing. So again, what it continues to tell us is that regardless of the skill set, regardless of the capacity and the capability, if it's not done from the right standpoint, it is of lesser or limited or no value. Verse 3 goes on to say, and though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing. So these three verses set the tone to say that regardless of what you have, regardless of the value that you have the capacity to add, if it's not done in the right mindset, it's not going to have that value. It's not going to provide what it could and what it should. Paul begins by providing a sense of priority here, letting the church know that their infatuation with these gifts, again, having them is a positive thing, and using them in the right way is a very valuable thing. But having them simply to have them is like having medals. You know, somebody who's in the military and has that nice, crisp uniform and has all the medals. They're a show. They're something that shows that you have them, but again, the value of it is lost on there. So again, there was a certain infatuation with these gifts, with keeping up with the Joneses, that I want to have all those credentials after my name. I want to have that piece of paper to show that I'm educated, and then I use that as a prideful thing to elevate myself over the next individual. It was keeping them from practicing them in a way that God intended them to. The second section of the chapter, verses 4 to 7, gets to the specifics of what we should and shouldn't see when love is in proper focus. So let's go into the next several verses, and I'm going to go in these in a little bit more detail as I go through each one of them rather than in introduction in groups. Verse 4 then, it begins to tell us it's these descriptors of what love is. And so as you read these, each one of us is going to have a little different perception. We're already in our minds perceiving someone who to us is a good practicer, is a good coach of love, and maybe someone that we've learned from, someone we hold in high esteem when they've gone through and walked through our lives and the lives of others. So verse 4 says, love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself and is not puffed up. So already in this very short fourth verse, we receive from there a number of descriptions as to what love does and does not do. First of all, it says love is long-suffering. The Greek word here is makrothumiai, and it hints at taking a long time to get hot. Like a high-performance car engine with a good cooling system, you can put it under a lot of stress. You can push it real hard. It'll perform for you, it'll get you where you want to go, and it'll get you there with some excitement. But it has the ability to keep itself cool. Another analogy could be a teapot. You put it on the stove with just a little bit of water. So if you were to fill one up, what I'm differentiating here is putting a teapot on with just a little bit of water on it. It's something that heats up quick. If we are shallow, or if the individual that's practicing love, or claims to be showing love at least, if they're shallow, if they're immature or unpracticed in showing love, they can overcome that love quickly. They can have the inability to keep it under cool. They can snap if they hit their boiling point quickly. But again, if we're deep, if we're full, if we're mature Christians, and we're willing to show it and practice it that way, we can stand up to the pressure and the heat and the transgressions that may be perpetrated against us. As I mentioned, things can be uncomfortable at the office. They can be hot because of deadlines. But again, can we hold our cool? Can we stand up under the pressure? One of the other scriptures that we often read is that, you know, that person that is slow to speak and slow to anger, they have control of their emotions. They have the ability to be long-suffering. So we can be long-suffering toward an individual in a relationship as we're trying to teach them, as they're trying to overcome something. We can be long-suffering in a moment when we have somebody, again, that's trying to heat us up, that's trying to push our buttons. We have the ability to stay cool in that situation. We show forgiveness. We show love. The second item here in verse 4, it said that love is kind. In Proverbs chapter 19 and verse 22, we have a reference to this. It says, here, you know, Solomon wrote here in Proverbs 19, it says, that which makes a man to be desired is his kindness. You know, one of the things that we love most about an individual are those little acts of kindness. You know, someone that, any number of things that you can do at home that you know your spouse likes. And they're things that bring a smile. They're things that bring a hug, that bring a warm caress of thanks. Because we're kind, because we know the things that somebody likes. And it says there in Proverbs 19:22, that which makes a man or a person to be desired is their kindness. In preparing the original message, there was a quote here. It says, there is many a woman who would trade a handsome husband for a kind one. And another one that says, kindness would stifle the plague of child abuse. And so we recognize that kindness, love, it says, is kind. And so kindness shown in our lives toward other beings makes the world a better place around us. The third one here, it says, love does not envy. They're still from verse 4, going through again the individual descriptors here of what love is and what it looks like in our lives. Sometimes we practice it better than others. You know, when we look upon our lives, we can say, I have been affected by the pressure, and maybe I've been a little quicker to snap at home or with others than I should be. So we'll go through these individual. Again, it says, love is not envious or love is not jealous. In Solomon chapter 8 and verse 6, or the Song of Solomon chapter 8 and verse 6, it says, the consuming flames of jealousy are as cruel as hell. And so when we look at that and we say, you know, when somebody stands there just feeling the heat, feeling the bake from envy and jealousy, it's something that consumes them. Jealousy is that feeling of displeasure caused by the prosperity of another. So when we see somebody else doing well, when we see somebody else collect some adulation, whether they deserve it or not, but we're saying, wait a minute, I wanted some of that. Or the last time I did that, I didn't get that. And so that's something that can eat at an individual and it consumes them. Something that's fueled not by the love of God, but by the jealousy over somebody else's situation. And it says love is not that way. So when we see the things in our lives that are positive, that it says love is and love does and love behaves this way, we got to look at it and thank you, Father, for the ability to understand that my life should be practiced that way. And when we see it in others, hopefully, that love is not this way, love performs not this way, we have to recognize that and make sure that we're pulling that out of our lives. Again, as we approach the Passover season, we need to be looking deep into the cabinets and under the covers and under the couch for the difficulties in our lives that we have not yet been able to remove. And we need to be pulling those out. It goes on to say in verse 4, it says, love is not puffed up. And again, as we look at the Greek here, it denotes one who is inflated with a sense of personal pride. So when somebody has done something praiseworthy, something good, something positive, that's fine. That's good. All of us should be developing those positive things in our lives. But when through that or because of that, you know, I have this thing that's of value and I'm prideful of that. And it makes me stand a little straighter. And it makes me evaluate myself a little greater than those around me that might not have this little treasure. Shame on us. Shame on the fact that love is not being extended or shown in our lives. Scripture tells us that pride comes before a fall. It's a cause of a number of problems. So we can look at a number of verses that tell us about that. You can write down Jeremiah chapter 49 and verse 16. Jeremiah chapter 49 and verse 16. It said, pride deceives the heart. So we're talking about love, and we know that love comes from the heart. It rests and nests in our heart, and then we give it to other people. We practice it. We extend it. But it said, pride deceives the heart. And so pride is going to, you know, deceit is something that pushes us sideways to see something out of focus. And so when pride is in the way, we can't properly show the love we should. We're deceived. We're knocked off center. Daniel chapter 5 and verse 20. Daniel chapter 5 and verse 20, another verse that talks about pride. And verse 4 here in 1 Corinthians 13 said that love is not puffed up. But Daniel chapter 5 and verse 20, it said pride hardens the mind. So our mind, our ability to logic, our ability to evaluate and see what we're doing wrong perhaps, blinds us to that pride. Pride deceives the heart and it hardens the mind. And then in Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 18, it said, pride results in destruction. Again, that's Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 18. And Proverbs is something that we could read through, and it's good to leave your Bible on the nightstand and open to that, that we read a few verses and dwell on them each and every day. There's a lot of wisdom in the book of Proverbs. Love, on the other hand, is characterized by genuine humility. And so humility and pride don't live together. And so we know that if we can be humble, if we have that love in our heart and we can come with that proper meek and humble attitude and operate through that during the day, then that love is going to have a way of showing in our lives and therefore reaching out and bubbling over into the lives of others around us. Brethren, we're only a single verse into the section, and already we can see beginning to see how complete this concept of love is. Let's move on to verse 5 here in chapter 13 of 1 Corinthians. It says, love does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not provoked, and thinks no evil. So it gives us, again, a number of things that, you know, as this was being written to a church that was faltering, that was having some difficulties, what he wrote was a very succinct bullet list to say, wait a minute, people, I came to you right away and I said, look, there are some issues that have crept in, there is some shortcoming that's going on here, and then he gives them this bullet list. It's like slap after slap after slap saying, this is what I'm seeing, and this is not love. And so he goes on here in verse 5, it does not behave rudely, it does not seek its own, it is not provoked, and it thinks no evil. Let's look at the first one. Love is not rude or unseemly. The Greek expression here for unseemly suggests the notion of being without form. So it's something that's not structured. It's not clear. It doesn't have a true form. You know, if you have glasses, if your glasses have ever gotten steamed up, when you're looking at something and you suddenly lose focus, something becomes a little bit nebulous. It's not clear and focused and straightforward as it should be. This without form or rude or unseemly could be considered to encompass all sorts of evil activity, bad manners, and brutality toward other people in their language and in their practice. Love, as we can see through the verses today, has a very specific form, a very specific structure and foundation in the way that we present it and extend it to other people. And so it is not rude. It is not unseemly. There are certain things that you just don't find in that structure. It says, love seeks not its own. Again, someone with true outgoing concern for their fellow man will think of their own interests only after knowing that the interests of others have been taken care of. It's been said that there are two kinds of people, those who are always thinking of their rights and those who concentrate instead on their responsibilities. Too few in today's society claim membership in that latter group. So when we look at the environment around us and we recognize that we have the opportunity to impact that environment, are we seeing the needs of others, the responsibilities that we have to fulfill them, to reach out to them and try to help them up? Something I read this last week, it says, never look down on people unless you're reaching down at the same time to help them up. And so that pride, again, that unseemly, that rudeness of thinking that you're better than someone else, and again, when I say you, please know, brethren, I'm not talking about you. I'm talking in a general sense, but each one of us needs to hear it and consider, does this point to me? And does it point to me, maybe not in general, but in any particular way? And so do the bells and whistles, do the warnings go off in my life when I'm feeling the pressure and I'm a little more quick to react? It says here that love is not provoked. Love takes no account of evil, and the description here deserves some attention. It doesn't mean that it's ignoring evil. When evil needs to be exposed or rebuked, it's clear, it's recognized, and love is prepared to stand its ground. But the Greek word here for account here refers to a commercial expression. It means that it's not kept record of, kept track of. Love, on the other hand, does not keep score in this way. We should not be keeping track of things like, you know, last week somebody didn't say hello to me. Last week somebody, you know, they spilled their coffee and I saw that they didn't clean it up. We don't keep track of those. We don't keep a journal of this person is showing more love. This person is better than that person. Remember? That pride and that evaluation needs to be a loving thing. And so we're quick to overlook something, to forgive something. Love doesn't keep score and allow grudge to develop. Instead, it practices perpetual forgiveness. You might write Matthew 18:22 in your notes. Matthew chapter 18, verse 22. This is where Christ told Peter to forgive not 7 times, but 70 times 7. So again, love is not keeping track of evils or something that was done wrong, or at least in your evaluation wasn't done well enough, but again, turns to that concept of forgiveness and covering over those type of things instead, forgiving those things. Moving on to verse 6, it says that love does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. This one's rather straightforward. We understand that love is concerned with the overall well-being of our brothers, and therefore, when someone has a positive thing done in their life, when they have been recognized for something they've done well, we rejoice in that. We show love and consideration and appreciation of that. And when truth is done, when right is done and righteousness is shown, again, love reaches out and appreciates that. Let's turn to Romans chapter 1, verse 28. We know that love is understanding that it's the well-being of our general brotherhood. It says to show love to all of mankind, so those that we have those strong relationships with and those that we might not have such a tight relationship with. But there are many that are diametrically opposed to that. They're mean-hearted, mean-spirited. They're cold-hearted, if you will. Romans chapter 1 and verse 28 talks a little bit about a certain portion of the population that we have to recognize that it's out there, and we have to guard against it. And when that love is strong in our hearts and strong towards people that show, we have a ability to insulate against this and to keep it at bay. Romans chapter 1 and verse 28, and we'll read a number of verses here. Again, verse 6 says, love does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. And what we're doing in Romans chapter 1 is showing that there is a part of this world that is very much foreign to that. Romans chapter 1 and verse 28, it says, even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting. And so, again, in 1 Corinthians chapter 13 here, it's a bullet list of things that love does, love is, and what it does not. And so here is a list in Romans chapter 1, verse 28 through 32 that talks about what a certain portion of this world practices and lives in. And God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting. Verse 29 says, being filled with all unrighteousness. So really, right from the beginning, it says everything that you can consider unrighteousness, these people just seem to absorb and practice and live in. All types of unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness, they're whisperers. So again, as we look at those people, and hopefully you're not too close to those people, hopefully you don't see too much of it, but as you see pieces, again, those things should create bells and whistles in our mind. We recognize, verse 6 says that we rejoice in the truth. So when somebody is When somebody shows love, even though they're not part of the family, when somebody shows concern for their neighbors, for their coworkers, we go up and we appreciate that. We give them kudos. We reinforce that in their lives. And when we see that which is not done, you know, it says that we don't keep account of it, but we really ought to be willing to step up and dig our heels in and let somebody know that, you know what, what you did, what you said was not right. That person didn't deserve that. And it really has no place here in our business. That's not easy to do. Very often we want to kind of, you know, I'll go over and I'll comfort the person that has been the recipient of that. But many of us don't like the confrontation of going to the person to say, wait a minute, I saw what you did. And I'm going to have my eye on you. Because that individual didn't deserve it, and nor will they deserve it tomorrow. And you know what? I'm looking out for those. You know, sometimes being a hero, we like to think that, but it's hard to go to somebody in the office and say, wait a minute, that wasn't fair. Knock it off. But that's what we need to do. So again, what we see here is those people, and this is a laundry list of terrible things. And again, hopefully we don't run into too many of them too often. Verse 30 here in Romans 1 continues. It says, these people are backbiters, they're haters of God, they're violent and proud. Now we see pride in ourselves, and we see it in those that we work with and have to live next to. But again, do we see it, and do we control it, and do we overcome it with love and kindness and patience? It goes on to say in verse 30, they're boasters, they're inventors of evil. So they're looking for trouble to get into. They're looking to get rich off the difficulties of others. They're looking for evil things. They're disobedient to their parents. So it's recognizing that at any level of life, this type of thing can start. And so our children need to recognize that what we do falls into these lists that God appreciates, and here a list that God condemns and will not bless and will not be in appreciation of. Again, these people will be disobedient to parents. So evil and that incorrect mind can start and does often start at a very young age. I've talked to some people here that have dealt with children and grandchildren that just had that difficult attitude, that always wanted to push, that always wanted to argue. And it's something, again, that can start very young, and we need to do our best in a loving way to help them overcome that. Continuing in verse 31, it says they're undiscerning, so they're sometimes even unaware of what it is that they do. They've gotten so accustomed to, and their attitude is just twisted enough that they don't even discern what's right and what's wrong. They're untrustworthy. They're somebody not to be trusted, not to be too tightly worked with or depended on. They're unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful. So all these things that show righteousness, all these things of love and forgiveness and mercy and trust and discernment that would elevate our character to be more God-like, it says they fall short on every single one of those qualities. Verse 32 goes on to say, who, meaning again, this list of people, this group of people that practices the thing on this list, who, knowing the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things are deserving of death, not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them. So there are those that do them unknowingly. They don't know any better. They don't know God. They don't know what that future holds. But it goes on to say that there are even those that know and still do them and still approve of those and still hang out with those and surround themselves in the company of those that practice these things. Brethren, it's a messed up human thought pattern that practices these things. But then again, we know the force that's working in this world today. And so we need to do our best to, again, insulate ourselves from that, from prevent that from being a part of our lives, and to take our loved ones and protect them from that as well. These are described as the sons of disobedience, and we need to make sure that we're not living alongside of and sometimes becoming affected by those individuals. Let's continue in verse 7 of chapter 13 of 1 Corinthians, this love chapter that we talk about. We've already seen several descriptions of what it does, what love does and doesn't do. Verse 7 now talks about a number of things that love does and love has and love practices. And it says, love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. Let's take a look at each one of those in a little bit more detail. Love bears all things. There's a sense of duality here in the verb. It provides a picture of one object on top of another. And with that concept, it can really take the place of either one. It can either be the bottom one that is supporting, where it says love bears all things. And so love supports when somebody is having difficulty in their lives. Love supports that. It bears the weight of the difficulty that that person is experiencing right now. The other concept is that it can be the upper of those two things, and it provides concealment or protection for the individual at the bottom that is maybe being bombarded by certain things and no longer, you know, is bending to that, and as an umbrella or as a shield, that upper one provides support and concealment and protection. Again, and the two aren't mutually exclusive. So, you know, there may be times when we kind of slide in to both sides of that. There will be times when somebody is strong and they don't need the support, but they need a little bit of protection to continue to help them gain that strength. Again, love supports and lifts up those that are in need. We act as a support system for our brethren here when we know that we're going through something. And by extension, we should be willing to act that same way toward all men. So when we have somebody in the office who's going through a difficult time, a divorce, if you will, we need to be able to be there to help them a little bit, simply as an ear to hear sometimes. I have a gentleman that I got to know when my children and I were taking Taekwondo over the last year. And toward the end of it, Charlie became rather talkative and found out that after 17 years, and he and his wife are in the midst of a pretty painful divorce. And so we're not taking the classes anymore. But a couple of weeks ago, I sent an email off to Charlie to say, you know, Charlie, how you doing? He was going to have knee surgery that was bothering him and that type of thing. And so we're going to plan to get together for lunch out into January sometime just to see how he's doing. He tells me he's still taking Taekwondo because it's the way that he still has the opportunity. They still haven't figured out who has the children and to what degree. And so it's an opportunity a couple of times for him during the week to still see his boys and to interact with them on a physical father-son type of thing. And so, you know, he's going through a tough time right now. And we should reach out and be there to support those people. Because ultimately, again, will somebody later have their eyes open and say, you know what, I remember when you didn't necessarily need to reach out. You had your own family, your own business, your own property, your own church to take care of and be active in, and yet we took the time to reach out to somebody else and support them and give them an opportunity to talk a little bit, and they're going to say, you know what, you did. You showed something, patience and kindness and love during that point in time. So again, we can be that support when somebody needs it. On the other sense, love provides cover, and we would be slow to expose the mistakes of another. So sometimes we have the opportunity to just say, yeah, I saw it, but nobody else needs to. That person doesn't need the pain and the exposure of that being made public, and therefore I can cover for them. You know, it's as a friend is there to help and to support and to cover and to take up the shortfall that sometimes happens. Again, we have the opportunity to show that love and to quietly mend that thing that needs fixing instead of exposing it as dirty laundry in public. Another thing that it told us in verse 7 here, it says that love believes all things. And it doesn't mean here that love is gullible, that the wool can be pulled over our eyes and that we're too much exposed to the problems of others. But there's a sense of the verb being translated as trusting, or to give the benefit of the doubt. We believe all things. We're willing to look for the good in a situation and to lift that up while we're willing to cover and have an opportunity to make improvements, sometimes behind the scenes perhaps. It goes on to talk also about love enduring all things. So even when there's adversity, even when there's challenge, again and again, love continues to operate. We spoke earlier of love being able to keep its cool. So love has a certain toughness. It's not easily discouraged. It has the ability to endure. Love, true love, does not give up. Let's continue in verse 8. Verse 8 begins the third section of this chapter and shows the superiority and the eternal nature of love. It says that people and things pass away. Even the supernatural gifts that God bestows on the Christians in Corinth will be practiced while they're alive, practiced while they're capable, but at some point that individual with that gift stops practicing that. But love itself is eternal and will move on and be shown through the people that are affected by that person's life, perhaps their children, people in their congregation who have seen the practice of that individual and have grown in their own ability to practice love and to extend it to others. Let's go with it. Please write down the following verses as reference scriptures. In my notes here, it says, so there you have it, the love chapter in 30 minutes or less. And as we talked about earlier, the concept of love is a very strong and broad one. And so it says, but we're not quite done, brethren. I don't mean to imply that this passage is incomplete, but there's a facet of love that we may not initially get from this text. And so I provide these three scriptures and then go into them in a little bit more detail. And I'll try to keep it short. So again, Matthew chapter 5 and verse 44. Matthew chapter 5 and verse 44. Luke chapter 6 and verse 27. Luke chapter 6 and verse 27. And then Luke chapter 6 and verse 35. Luke chapter 6 and verse 35. And if you would turn to Luke chapter 6 and verse 35. It says, after you've written these down, let's turn to Luke 6 to see this other facet. This twist that makes the task even a little bit more challenging. Appreciate that. So I'm going to read a couple of these first. Matthew chapter 5 and verse 44, you don't need to turn there, it's a single verse. It says, Christ said to pray for those who spitefully use you. So again, what we're doing is we're taking a little bit of a twist and a turn here. So you see, it's not just being nice to those that are nice to us, as we can see in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 44. In Luke chapter 6 and verse 27, it was the second one that I had you write down. Matthew chapter 6 and verse 27, it says, but I say to you that hear. So this is now to those, so for you that will pay attention, for you that haven't already closed your ear to this concept of love, to those that are willing to listen and interested in following me through the change that's necessary in their lives, I say to you, love your enemies and do good to those who hate you. So we picture human nature here stepping back and say, wait a minute, the concept of love I understand, but love ought to be fair. It ought to be going both ways. So it's easy to love those who love me. It's easy to take care of those who are willing to take care of me in my moments of need. But now you're saying to love my enemies? That's so contrary to human nature, so contrary to what we often see and have learned to practice in our own lives. And so again, something that sounds a little bit difficult. Verse 28 goes on to expand on this idea in Luke 6:27. It says, "Bless those who curse you and pray for those who abuse you." So now it's really starting to sound a little uncomfortable. Why do I need to do that? Why does that person deserve love from me and care from me and support from me and cover from me? But if you remember this concept that we started at the beginning of the sermon, love is many layered, and we see love between God and Christ, perfect love, practiced that in every way, in every moment. And then we see the love of God and the Son shown toward human beings in general, the sacrifice that was made for all of us. So wait a minute, if that sacrifice was made for all of us, then I certainly am required, if I'm going to be one of God's children, to show that as well. And then that third concept was love shown here within the group that needs to be a stronger and a very consistent love shown. And so we don't have the ability, we don't have the right to step back and say, no, there's only certain people that I'm going to show love to. And it's specifically put in our laps here that we need to show love to everybody, even in the difficult times. Continuing in verse 29, it says, bless those who strike you on the cheek, and to those who that do, offer the other also. And from him who would take away your coat, do not withhold your shirt either. And so it pushes the envelope here as to how we might practice love. Yes, I've been called. Yes, I've been baptized. Yes, I understand that I'm supposed to have love in my life and practice love toward others. Yes, I read the scripture that says God is love, and I'm striving to understand that more and more all the time and to practice it in my life. But there's only so far I will go. To those that show love to me, it's easy. To those that I don't really know, but I can pass on the street and I can hold the door for them and I can smile them, I can show them love and some outgoing concern. But there are some incorrigibles out there that don't deserve it. And that's a line we can't step over. Because it says, even to those, show love. Every human being deserves that. Going on in verse 30, it says, give to everyone who begs from you, and of him who takes away your goods, do not ask them again. This, brethren, isn't saying that when somebody borrows your tools, you're not to expect them back. But it says when you consider the concept of love, you've got to push it to the nth degree. Because if you want, what did we cover earlier? My ways are higher than yours, and my thoughts are higher than yours. We can't use that as an excuse to say that I'm only going to operate at this level. We need to push, and we need to grow, and we need to develop as far as we possibly can. And we do that by pushing ourselves beyond the level that's comfortable. It says everybody deserves your love. And when you can operate at this level, you're making it. You're getting the traction that I want you to in your lives. And so he's telling them, practice it this way. Verse 31 goes on to say, and as you wish that men would do to you, do so to them. There again, it's easy for us to say, yeah, but I'm a nice person for the most part. And I'm trying to practice this thing, these things. So of course I want people to do nice to me because I'm generally a nice person. But it said, at every level we would want this. And so to every level, to every other person, we need to practice love to our greatest capacity. We can continue. So again, at this point, you know, many people would say, well, there's my out. You know, as I would do to other people, you know, do unto others as you want done to you. But if you're that nice person, okay, that cuts the line. That's not what God says. And we saw it earlier in the other verses as well. Continuing in verse 32, it says, if you love those who love you, what credit is that for you? So it says, if you're nice to those that are nice to you, big deal. That's to be expected. Even individuals who aren't really nice people practice that way because it's business. One hand washes the other. I'll be nice to you, and I expect payback at some point. What credit is that for you? For even sinners do that. Verse 33, and if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do that. Again, they have a certain symbiotic relationship back and forth. But I expect more from you. Verse 34 goes on even one level. And if you lend to those from whom you hope to receive back, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. They do business each and every day, expecting to receive back and then with interest. Verse 35. This was the third of the three verses that I asked you to reference, and really the second two were stringing together. But in Luke chapter 6 and verse 35, it says, summarizes, but love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return. And again, what we need to recognize is that when we can do that, when we can give for the sake of giving, when we can do for the sake of doing, that's truly our heart saying, outgoing concern for the well-being of others. It's the concept behind it that we need to get and that we need to operate from. When you can do, when you can love, and when you can do, and when you can lend, expecting nothing in return, then your reward will be great, and you will be sons and daughters of the Most High, for He is kind to the ungrateful and to the selfish. What if God practiced love to those that practiced love? He practiced love to us. He made a sacrifice to us when we didn't qualify yet. And that's not to say that we qualify yet today. We're striving, we're growing, we're improving. But at any point where we sin, God can turn His back and say, wait a minute, I made it very clear to you guys, I don't reside with sin. And I don't reside with those that limit their love to other people. Because it's not thorough, it's not complete. God gave His only Son while we were yet sinners. We read that earlier in Romans 5:8. And He did it on our behalf when we were still ungrateful and selfish. And brethren, we need to remember that. When we have the opportunity to practice and show love and patience and kindness and support and cover, when we have the opportunity to show all that, we need to do it because we know that God did it on our behalf first. When we do that, we begin to exhibit God's character in our lives, something that we need to be growing and developing each and every day. Agape is a gracious and determined and active interest in the true welfare of others. It's not deterred even by hatred, cursing, and abuse. Brethren, there are some people, there are some parts of society that are hard to love. And yet God does that. And so we need to be willing and working to overcome that barrier that we put up there. We need to be working each and every day to do it a little bit better, to do it a little bit more thoroughly. Are we succeeding, brethren, in showing true, pure, active concern for the well-being of everyone we meet? I quoted earlier from Vine's Expository Dictionary, and it continues on this topic of love, saying the following. Christian love, whether exercised toward the brethren or toward men in general, is not an impulse of feelings. It does not always run with the natural inclinations, nor does it spend itself only upon those for whom some affinity is discovered. We, brethren, have an affinity here. We've developed a relationship. We gather with people of like mind, and there's a comfort in that. But it says that love spends itself not only upon those for whom some affinity is discovered. Love seeks the welfare of all and works no ill toward any. Love seeks opportunity to do good to all men, and especially toward them that are of the household of faith. So not just, this is natural. This is something that we would expect. This is something that comes comfortably. But when we walk out of those doors, do we have that same fire burning in us? Maybe not to the same level. Sometimes you'll show love. Sometimes you'll say hello to somebody on the street, and they'll look at you kind of strange. They're not expecting it. They're not ready to share it. And if somebody's going to look at you strange for a hello, imagine if you stuck your hand out. Excuse me? They don't have that affinity. They don't have that relationship. But we have to be willing to show love, concern, openness, kindness, friendliness to everybody, to the level to which they'll accept it. Because we're evaluated based on what we show, not what they will receive, and not how they receive it, but how we extend it, brethren. As a closing scripture today, let's turn, brethren, to Colossians chapter 3 and verse 12. Colossians chapter 3, verses 12 through 14. We all still find this topic of love somewhat overwhelming. You know, there are days that we're better at it. Days that we wake up and we just feel warmer. We feel stronger. We had some good done to us yesterday, and so we kind of hit the road with some traction, with some spring in our step. But we don't succeed every day. That's an understatement. But it's my task and it's yours to strive, to understand, and then to live it a little better each day as best we can. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 12. Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering. Many of these, brethren, we read in 1 Corinthians 13 when it said, love is kind, love is long-suffering, love covers and supports and protects. Again, Colossians chapter 3 and verse 12. Therefore, as the elect of God, brethren, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering. As you would put your coat on, make sure that you're wrapped in these things. Make sure that you're cloaked in these things. Verse 13, bearing with one another. What did it say? It was long-suffering. It would bear up and it would cover. Forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another. So if you have a complaint against somebody else, you've got to be willing to let that go. Forgiving that. Even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do. Verse 14. But above all these things, put on love. Brethren, we need to put on love, and we need to show it generously toward each other and toward all men. Put on love, which is the bond of perfection.